Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
All right, here we are. I'm Serge.
I'm Chris Weber.
And here we are on Libre Lounge. So we've just had Thanksgiving. Did you have a good Thanksgiving, Chris?
I did have a good Thanksgiving. You know, I guess that's a bit U.S. centric of us, but I enjoy the time with my family, and it's nice to be able to go and meet up with everyone. And also, Thanksgiving is a good time to, you know, reconnect with people, and then also happily head home too.
Yeah, I had Thanksgiving in Canada with my sweetie. Canadian Thanksgiving is in October, so we had American Thanksgiving in Canada. yeah. So some quick news. We had some great feedback on our first episode. People complimented the topics. They complimented the audio quality, which was kind of funny. But people seem generally excited, and we're happy to produce our second episode.
Yeah, the response definitely got me very excited about jumping into the next episode. And, you know, I had a lot of fun recording it, so I'm very excited to be back here and to knock more of these out.
So on the topic of things that we're thankful for on free software, I want to say again how thankful I am for the people who've listened to the podcast, who are continuing to listen through our first episode, now to our second, and who have supported us. I also want to make a little shout out to Software Freedom Conservancy, which is an organization dedicated to, I guess, supporting and protecting free software. They are having a pledge drive currently, and would love people to support them. I know that you're a big supporter of them too, Chris.
Yeah, yep. Conservancy does great work for so many projects, and also for, in many ways, Conservancy is, I consider to be not just this amazing kind of foundation of support for all these different projects, but also a really important voice keeping free software kind of in keeping moral grounding for free software in a way that I think is very constructive.
I agree. And we should do a whole episode on Conservancy in the future. But I just,
maybe we can get some Conservancy people on this podcast.
Yeah. In fact, you know, this podcast was inspired by the two now leaders of Software Freedom Conservancy, Bradley Kuhn and Karen Sandler's podcast Free Isn't Freedom. And that inspired us to decide to make this podcast. So yeah, I think it'd be great if in the future we could get them. One more quick shout out. I am now on the Fediverse. Over the Thanksgiving break, I installed Mastodon, which is a popular ActivityPub-powered communication platform. So you can find me at emaxin at emaxin.net. And I think we'll probably by the next episode have a Mastodon instance for, or at least an account for the show, and a Twitter account.
Yeah, I think, you've been very strong on the reminding ourselves to explain what topics are. So maybe you should define the term Fediverse.
Yeah, so the Fediverse is a term that we should have a whole topic about what federation is, but it basically means the social media platforms that are user controlled rather than necessarily large corporate control, and that allow users to communicate with each other across servers in the same way that email works across servers. So if you have maybe an email account at your school or your work, it works seamlessly with, you know, Gmail or Yahoo or what any other system. So in the same way, there's no reason that social media has to be controlled by these silos. Instead, the Fediverse allows everyone to be on equal footing. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right. And yeah, definitely a lot of opinions and thoughts that we could, that I can certainly throw into that since I have some amount of background in Fediverse development. That's right.
But I know that the big news on your mind was NPM. So I thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit. You could introduce it. I'll talk about it. And then maybe I'll just hand it over to you.
Okay. So so it's partly about NPM. It's partly about this specific incident kind of, I think that this leads into a number of larger topics. Well, okay, I'm doing a bad job. I should just jump into specifically what the incident is. So recently, there was a package on NPM, which is the Node Package Manager, very common package manager for JavaScript libraries, especially the Node.js ecosystem.
Actually, let me jump in. So, because realized we talked about this. I said I would do this a little differently. So I'm gonna do the headline. I'm gonna jump into some detail for our non-technical listeners, and then I'm gonna hand it back to you. So the headline is that in one of the NPM libraries, it was found that there was some code to that made every application that was using this library into a Bitcoin miner that the developer was profiting from. So meaning the author of the library was profiting from. Is that about accurate?
I'm not sure it was turning into a Bitcoin miner. I think it was stealing Bitcoin private keys so that it could steal the data directly. So it could steal your coins directly, not just mine.
Okay, that's far worse than I'd heard. So let's explain just to our non-technical users what a library is, what Node is, what NPM is, and then go from there. So if you're writing a complex piece of software, it's a lot like building a car or an airplane or a house. If you tried to build every single component yourself, it'd be impossible. So if you're building a car, you know, you might use the engine from one company or the body from another company or the brakes or the brake pads from a third company, and you'd put them together. You'd engineer things to work together, but you as a car manufacturer don't have to build every single part yourself. In the same way, software developers don't have to design every single piece of code that goes into a very large, complex piece of software. Instead, we use libraries. And libraries are just pre-existing components that we tie together. We call it gluing them together. But we basically integrate large pieces of software. And sometimes when we're writing software, we build new libraries that we then let others use. But libraries are basically, you can think of them as off-the-shelf components that we use. Node is a software system built on top of JavaScript. JavaScript is the library that's most commonly used in web browsers, but it has been used by the people at Node to write servers. And NPM is just you can think about it like a catalog of libraries. So in the same way, if you're building a car, you'll know about all the different brakes that exist on the market, and you can just order some. With NPM, you can just look through all the software packages, the software libraries that exist for Node, and then you can just say, oh, I'd like this, and I'd like that, and I'd like that. And NPM just makes that really easy.
That's right. That's right. Also, one bit of meta. One comment we got on the last episode was that we explained things like what Git and GitHub were, and my response to that is if you would like a version of this podcast that doesn't go into the technical details, it's free culture, and you can make that modified version yourself. Sorry, that's an aside. But I think that in general, we're going to want to go into the amount of detail that we feel like on these episodes. But I suppose that was quite a diversion. So jumping back into it about the specific piece of software. This piece of software was called EventStream. And what's interesting about, you know, it's stealing the software, stealing, you know, people's private keys is, well, a couple of things. That it's kind of interesting that it was able to, and I guess we'll get to why it's interesting that it was able to later, but also, it's not the first of, kind of fiasco in packaging in NPM land recently. There have been a few of them recently, one of them being ESLint also had a backdoor inserted into it for stealing NPM credentials. Now, if I remember correctly, that one was about stealing the tokens that allow you to upload packages to NPM itself, whereas this one's about stealing the keys behind your, you know, virtual money of Bitcoin. What's interesting about both of those is that they were both about intercepting the packages that people were installing, these libraries. But in the case of ESLint, that one was, I think, intercepted the, didn't try to attack the upstream code. Instead, it was the uploaded release, the uploaded kind of release package that was installed in, from the package manager. So sometimes software is developed in, you know, some sort of version control system. And then when releases happen, you know, they are kind of these separate pieces that get uploaded to some sort of package repository derived from that. And in the ESLint scenario, that's what happened there. But in this new one, in the event stream category, they actually... the attack happened at the upstream development. And the way that it happened was the person who was behind this library originally has worked on a lot of different things. And they were like, oh, you know, I'm not maintaining this. And another person said, I volunteer to maintain it. And so the original maintainer is like, okay, sure, take over. And that person who took over inserted the malicious code into upstream. So that's interesting because we haven't had an attack like that directly in upstream before. Now, one more mention of another fiasco-ish in NPM that's fairly different was that there is this left pad chaos that happened where somebody just they got a cease and desist about one of their other packages, and they said, you know what, screw it, and deleted all of their packages.
You know what, let's put that on hold just because that's a whole nother topic. Or
yeah, I agree. So that one actually, I guess, goes off in the
I want to sort of stay on this NPM and explain a little bit more about what the attack was and how it happened and what we mean by malicious code and all of these
sure,
things.
Sure,
so,
okay.
So let's take this one at a time. And I see what you're seeing about this attack on Bitcoin. So I think most of our audience will know that Bitcoin is a form of online currency. So basically, when Chris says attacking Bitcoin and attacking Bitcoin wallets, what he means is stealing people's money, right? So this piece of software was used to steal people's money, and there's a lot that's interesting here, in that. The attack was not, as I had originally thought, to mine Bitcoin on servers, but rather to attack and to find Bitcoin, basically find the money that's on developers' laptops and desktops as they're working, find those wallets, steal the money out of them, and then move that money. That's a much different scenario than we've seen previously.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like as if, and since it was stealing the credentials, it's kind of like it was, you know, finding the way to log into your bank account, right? It's that basically the equivalent of that, because, you know, your private key is how you control your account in Bitcoin.
Right. This isn't the first malicious code. So when we say malicious code, we mean, you know, a program, again, a library is supposed to do something, right? It's supposed to do some kind of thing for your program. But if it's doing something other than that, especially something harmful, right, that's malicious code. So this isn't the first time in the free and open source software world that we've seen malicious code. I remember in 2003, a backdoor was placed in one of the Linux kernel mirrors. So one of the places you could download from had injected some malicious code into their version of the kernel that you could download. That was found relatively quickly, but it brought up a whole lot of issues around version control, and we could have a whole episode just about Git and how that incident actually was one of the reasons that Linus Lugtun took version control more seriously. We've also seen attacks. Let me just finish this one part. We've also seen attacks where someone will take a piece of free software and then put some malware in that and then package that up as a binary and upload it somewhere. So if people remember the website SourceForge, it used to be a huge hub. It used to be sort of the GitHub of the 1990s and early 2000s for free software. And once people moved away from there, malicious people started putting malware into SourceForge programs, and SourceForge became an unreliable place for us to get free software for this reason. And I know that we could have a whole episode, and I think we will have an episode about reliable builds and why this is important, but throwing it back to you.
Okay, yeah. So what's interesting is that the kernel example that you brought up, I think, is much closer to the kind of the ESLint, which is not the one that that's very recent. It's the other one that where, you know, kind of uploading the package, right? So you're not really targeting the upstream developers. Instead, you're trying to kind of man in the middle it in some ways. And the SourceForge thing is also an interesting man in the middle thing, especially because the recent SourceForge stuff, SourceForge itself participated in man-in-the-middling things, right? So like the GIMP, you would download it from SourceForge, and then SourceForge was actually overriding the Windows binaries and installing some stuff. And now, so the new owner of SourceForge has apologized and, you know, has said, you know, we're not doing that anymore and stuff like that. But, you know, it's interesting that, but in both of those cases, it was not really the upstream developers that were really involved in that attack, right?
Right. They're sort of like, so, you know, in this case, SourceForge and the Linux mirrors are like distributors, right? So they're not the ones producing the original software. They're the ones that offer a place to download it. They're just a place where you can get it. But the original pristine, what we call upstream software, was always free of that kind of attack.
Right. And so what's interesting to me now is that, and we'll get into this more later, but I'm not trying to actually, I think that, I mean, the person who actually did the malicious stuff, I think we are in full rights to attack. But the person who handed things over, and I guess that's getting a little bit too ahead of ourselves, I'm not as interested in attacking that right there, because in some ways, this is the first time that we've really seen this happen, right? Previous to this moment, I think we just, in some ways, if somebody offered to take over one of my free software projects, and yes, you could say, okay, well, they should have looked at the development history. You know, did that person work on any free software projects before? Did they have this social presence and stuff like that? Blah, blah, blah. But I mean, being a maintainer is hard. And prior to this moment, I don't think the attack scenario had really happened in practice where you'd say, oh, you know, somebody who's offering to take over a package may actually be doing so because they want to intercept the upstream in some way, right? I don't believe I've heard of an example like that. Have
no,
you?
I've never heard of that either. And I think this is an important part of a larger conversation that we'll have to have in a future time about, you know, what it means to write software and what your social obligation is. So if I write a program, and I've written plenty of these little programs that get used by maybe, and in my case, you know, maybe a dozen or a couple dozen people, and in your case, you know, thousands of people. And then it comes time that, you know, years down the road, somebody wants a feature or somebody finds a bug, and maybe you've moved on and don't want to work on that program anymore. And if someone says, oh, well, if you don't want to work on it, don't worry, I'll take over, I'll work on it. I have a reason, I've got a motivation, I've got a use case for this, and I'm going to be a good steward of your work and move it forward. There's a lot of gratitude, right? Like, oh, good, I don't have to do this anymore.
Right.
But as you say,
it could be even a sign of relief. Yeah. Right. Like, oh, I felt guilty that I was not keeping this up to date.
Right. And so, what's interesting here, and again, we can get into a whole long topic about what distributed software looks like, distributed software development. But, what Chris is saying is if he wrote something, and then gave it up to another person, the software is going to look like it's still the officially blessed version, the version that Chris made. And that's important because there's some social clout around the official upstream version that now this developer, who is in this case malicious, has inherited. But we've had free software since the 80s. And as Chris said, this is the first time we've really seen this attack in real life.
Right. So I guess I want to throw this back to you. Why do you think this is new? Is it because, and what prevented it before, right? Was it the hacker ethic that kept it from somebody doing this type of thing? Why now?
I think there's a number of reasons. So first of all, so we have pretty good permission system, and I know you want to talk about permissions in GNU Linux, so we'll talk about that. But it's really, you know, you brought up the example of stealing your bank credentials, right? Well, it's actually fairly hard to find someone's bank credentials in standard free software. Like, you'd have to put a program that would log every keystroke and go through that. And while that is possible, those are relatively easy to find, right? Programs that do that are relatively easy to find and to stop. So it's been tricky to put in that kind of malicious code. It also speaks to how many libraries are out there, right? There's been this huge, I don't want to say exponential because I don't, you know, somebody with a math degree is going to look at the software and tell me it's not exponential. But there's a ton of code out there. There's more source code running on my, you know, GNU Linux desktop than I could ever read in my entire life. Right? There's right. no
You're
way.
You're never going to be able to audit
the entire,
your entire, your the every single bit of software that's on there. It would take many, many lifetimes.
And so, and I would even say that for most of the software that I use and software that I develop, I'm reliant on other people to have done that work. There's just so much code out there, right? So if I'm writing a program in, let's say, Python, right, which is a fairly common programming language, I'm going to be using a bunch of Python libraries that I choose to download. I'm also then, so I'm trusting all of them. I'm trusting the Python runtime environment. I'm trusting Python itself. I'm trusting the operating system that runs underneath Python. I'm trusting the web server. I'm just trusting a whole bunch of software that, you know, that it just works. And I think that's it doesn't just apply to software. It's an infrastructure issue, right? When I walk down the street, or drive a car, I trust that all these checks have been done, that the street is safe, that the car is safe. You know, I don't have to think about that. I can focus on just doing my task. I think that, you know, I do think it's interesting that where we are in terms of why hasn't this attack come before? But I think the opposite question is just as interesting, which is, well, not just why now, but why has it taken this long? And I think because it's difficult, and B, because we're, you know, the number of people who are software developers is still relatively low, right? This is an attack that only applies to people developing software on their computers. Now, the one thing that we didn't mention is just how popular this software library is. I think I saw one estimate that said there was over 2 million downloads of this thing a week. That doesn't mean there's 2,000 developers, but, you know, that means that there could be thousands of developers using this one software library.
So I don't agree with you that this that it's hard to exploit free software operating systems that they are, and that the security is particularly good. I guess we'll get into that more later. But I actually think that the idea that it's really hard to do these types of things is actually false. I think what's protected us is not that free software has a particularly good security story, because I actually think that we don't, right? Like, so for example, you can write to this special file that Xorg or XLM or whatever you want to call it, your kind of display management system is, and you can pretty much intercept and run any command as long as you have the ability to write to that, sort of. Basically, there are so many layers of our system that are dramatically unsafe. And all software that we run runs basically as us, right? So if I run Solitaire, it is a very dangerous program. It can read all of the files on my operating system and upload it to a website and delete any files it wants. And why can it do that? And so, okay, I'm definitely jumping ahead here, but I think that but as for why did it not happen till now, I don't think that because we have particularly safe designs. I used to believe that, and I don't anymore. I think I used to believe that more when I was coming from the Windows background, and in comparison to what I used on Windows 95 and 98, you know, the Unix access control list model seemed so much better. But really, I run so much software, and as you said, have to trust so much of it. I really think that what's kept us safe is the hacker ethic in many ways. Is, you know, you hinted at this, you know, who is developing the software. You hinted at it, I think, with the, you know, when, you know, like, what's the incentives of the people who are developing it, right? So I know you had a little bit more that you wanted to say about the incentives of people who are developing things, I think.
No, I think you might be right. And let's jump into this. So there have been attempts. So actually, let's start with what we mean by running as yourself, right? So if I'm running a program on my computer, I log into my computer as myself, and I run my email program, or I run my web browser or whatever, the web browser is able to do anything on behalf of me. It's basically acting as an agent of mine in a sort of a social legal sense, right? It can do anything that I can do, and so can my email program, or so can my PDF reader. So if my PDF reader is malicious and it wants to go and talk to the internet, it can, right? Just the same way my web browser can, even if I don't think that my PDF reader should be doing that. Or, you know, maybe my MP3 player happens to be, you know, listening into my keystrokes and sending that off somewhere. Well, that's theoretically possible. And there have been attempts in the past to put different permission systems on top of the permission systems that were traditionally used in our Unix-based operating systems. By the way, when I say Unix-based operating systems, I of course mean GNU Linux, but I also mean for Mac users, OS X, as well as FreeBSD and others. So there were mandatory access control methods that were put into SE Linux and also AppArmor. AppArmor did gain some traction for a while, but these systems have traditionally been pretty cumbersome and hard to use, hard to configure, and just difficult to work with. There's sandboxing, which is used in Android, the Android operating system, and there's also sandboxing and virtualization used in CubeOS or Cubes. I believe it's CubeOS, which I will link to, which is a new operating system that is GNU Linux based, which allows for every application to be either virtualized or containerized in such a way that things can't touch each other. Applications can't do malicious things to each other. So including access to the file system or making network calls or whatever. So these systems do exist, but traditionally they've been fairly cumbersome.
Right. So, okay. So I have a lot of thoughts on this. So one thing that you pointed out was that a lot of these things could have malicious bits in them, right? So let's go to the email client, right? So maybe I downloaded a malicious email client, and it's very easy for us to, you know, blame that. Or you can imagine that my email client has a malicious library in it, right? But is there really a distinction between that, where it's a malicious component, or a buggy component that can be exploited? And in my view, there's no distinction. There's a distinction in some ways of what the intent was, but there's very little distinction that's important in terms of security defense. There is actually a difference there in, when it comes to the accountability point. But when it comes to let's say I'm using my email client. Well, it may not be that my email client is malicious or buggy in a way that it's vulnerable itself. So tying back into the original topic, it could be that it depends on a library that is in some sort of way buggy, right? So maybe it's using libpng or libjpg or something like that, that like either of these libraries just renders an image, right? And it's just got a pinprick-sized vulnerability in it, like just the tiniest, a single line of code that's just the smallest little bug that opens up an incredibly vast, can do anything as you exploit, right? Like some sort of, you know, stack management, memory management type issue. The technical details don't matter. But the point is that either through malice or through bugs, something like this can happen. And what's interesting is that we have seen a lot from the bug category over the last many years, right? Like the, especially in memory management issues, that's not new, right? We've seen lots and lots and lots. And actually, if you read LWN.net and look at their security advisories thing, it's kind of heart-stopping to see that every day you have to churn to keep your system up to date to escape from a nonstop slew of discovered vulnerabilities. And those are just the ones that have been discovered, right? Your system is vulnerable right now, right? Like, guaranteed. It's just which ones have been discovered and have been patched, and are you up to date on those patches?
Yeah,
right?
And I think another part that gets that goes unrecognized by a lot of people, developers included, is that we rely on a lot of development that is self-reporting, right? So that we assume that a developer who finds a bug, especially a security bug, is going to take care of it. And when they do, they'll put out a security release and a patch. And then the application authors will integrate that patch or that security update or the operating system or the distribution. In the case of GNU Linux, they'll integrate that, and that essentially works a lot like a product recall, right? So a new version of a library comes out, and everyone is assumed to update their software regularly, and then that gets fixed. And it's considered important that, you know, you keep your system up to date, not just with your own program, but with all the programs that it depends on, which can be a fairly long list, because as you say, maybe you rely on this library, but that library has its own things that it depends on. And so it's impossible for anyone to know about everything that's going on. And so instead we rely on this partially organized and partially social contract of good faith and effort to keep our systems up to date.
Right. So let's get into the, you know, why did NPM, you know, why is it that we've seen these number of issues in NPM recently? I think over the last year is when we saw all three of these. And I think to get into that, so one reason that I think that this may be happening is that, you know, both NPM happens to, unlike a lot of other software, target both servers and clients, and with the most popular client in the world, right, which is a web browser. Right. So JavaScript is pretty much everywhere. So that makes it appealing. But I also think that in some ways, NPM's packaging is a mess more so than other package managers. Now, I'd like to get into how we might improve and defend these things. But I also want to emphasize that I don't want to get into a very blamey approach about that, because I actually don't think that many of the things that are being developed are these problems are happening because people are, you know, there's a very big temptation to be like, look at this person being incompetent. And I think that that's actually fairly rare. What I tend to think is more frequently the case is what are our current infrastructure and best practice approaches? And though fixing those sometimes requires moving forward as kind of a developer society, right, to make things better. And so when I'm focusing on these things, I want to emphasize that I'm not interested in playing the blame game, right? I think you probably have a similar feeling.
In fact,
right?
I think it undermines our larger cause, right? So we could have a whole podcast about the individual who put this one malicious code into this one library that's used everywhere, and we could talk about what a terrible person he is and how he shouldn't have done that. That doesn't protect us,
right? And I mean, this person has built a lot of software. And has tried pretty hard. And, you know, as we said earlier, it appears what happened was somebody offered to help them and they took up that help, you know, and granted, did they do enough of a background check to find out? Maybe not.
Well, but I mean, even if we talk about the person, and I'm sorry, I don't remember this person's name, the person who actually put the malicious code in, right? The malicious code author. Right. Even if we talk about that person in particular and talk about what a terrible person they are, it's.
Yeah, I'm not sure we know what their identity is. I think that they hadn't really done anything before.
Got it. So, you know, but it doesn't get to our larger point. I know you've got a lot of opinions about the way operating systems and libraries should talk to each other. You've talked not necessarily in this podcast, but in previous. In another podcast, you talked about object capabilities, and I'm very interested in object capabilities. I think we don't have time for a deep dive, but how you think that NPM and the JavaScript world is more vulnerable. I'd like to hear about that. I'd like to hear about object capabilities and especially how object capabilities is distinct from mandatory access control, because that mandatory access control is an approach that we have tried and has not worked for us.
Right. So why don't we get, okay. So I wrote out three different sections for talking about how to prevent issues like this, and object capabilities is the most complex one. So let's do it last. I mean, it's not a complex topic, but it's the most kind of new things introduced. So first of all, I think we should recognize that we want to do a defense in depth approach, right? So, we don't want to just say, aha, here's the magic bullet. And then security's fixed or solved, right? So we do want to create a security culture. We do want to, you know, do a number of different things, but I think that object capabilities help a lot, but let's also review the other two points. So the first one I would say is accountability. So we talked about this already, kind of like, you know, in a certain sense, this person, the original author, Dominic Tarr, I think, was contacted by this, you know, this malicious user and said, I want to take over. Well, you know, should there be more of, you know, an accountability structure, right? So I think you and I are somewhat skeptical that, that there's good reason to blame this person, partly because we haven't seen this attack before, but maybe, you know, sometimes when these things happen, it does change the way that people work on things. And in some other projects, we do see accountability becoming more serious, right? Like, so both the Linux kernel, the Linux kernel and Debian both have accountability structures, correct?
Yeah. So in Linux, if you want to put source code into the Linux kernel, now, of course, you can always make your own version of the Linux kernel. But if you want to be in one of the official Linux kernel, you have to find the subsystem that you're interested in introducing your changes to. You have to work with the delegated. I don't think they call them officers, but we'll call them the person in charge of that subsystem. So, for example, if you want to work on the sound part of the Linux kernel, there's a person. I'm sorry, I don't know their name. Who's in charge of sound? Right? And there's another person who's in charge of networking. Another person who's in charge of say memory management. And so, if you want to make a change, you have to work with that person. And Linus, who is in charge of the whole project, he doesn't have to know about every single developer. He delegates responsibilities to people that he has a trust relationship with.
That's right. So, I agree with that. There's also this sign-off on approach that the Linux kernel has, which we don't really need to go into, but it's another layer of kind of accountability. Granted, somebody new can come in and throw in a patch and sign off on it, and it may not be noticed that that person really hasn't built up a reputation. But honestly, discovering reputation about a newcomer can be pretty hard, right? Maybe you up the game when somebody's offering to take over as maintainership, but this attack could have been introduced with a patch that introduced an attack that wasn't caught on code review as well, even though I think it was a little bit more obviously viewable in this case. So the next in-depth defense in-depth approach, I would say, is reproducibility. And so I want to say that I think actually NPM is particularly bad here. So I wrote a blog post, I guess we'll link to it in the show notes, called JavaScript, Let's Package jQuery, a JavaScript packaging dystopian novella. And I think it got one of the most views of any blog post I've ever written, probably because people who are in the distribution land probably have felt the pain of that more often. So there are two GNU Linux distributions that really care a lot about reproducibility. And those are Debian and Geeks, GUIX. I would say that both of those have a big focus on reproducibility and making sure that everything can be built from source and stuff. And notably, both of those communities have had a really awfully hard time getting NPM packages in. And this is partly due to the way that many NPM packages are so small. They're like, usually the package definitions can be very frequently larger than the package itself, because it can just be like 50 lines long, and then you just have, you know, hundreds of those tiny packages. And so it's very hard to, you know, stay on top of that. Whereas more traditionally, before NPM, I think packages tended to be kind of larger libraries tended to be larger sets of code, right? So, and in fact, I mentored a Google Summer of Code project to get NPM packaging support into Geeks, and we did that. The student did that, but unfortunately, we didn't actually get the packages themselves into Geeks, and that was because of kind of the reasons I mentioned, and also because there's a number of other messes that I do actually think NPM needs to improve on, right? Like the licensing is very frequently not actually defined very well. So it's possible to have a lot of very small non-free packages. And also people may upload packages without having tried to make them reproducible. So
I've got a question here. I know a little bit about software reproducibility and build reproducibility, and again, I'm sure we'll have a whole show on that, because it's an area of my interest, and I know it's somewhat of an interest in, I was going to say somewhat of a passion of yours, but I don't know if it goes that far. So JavaScript is we'll just call it an interpreted language. And for our non-technical listeners, we don't need to worry about what that is. It's an interpreted language. And that makes it similar to Perl and similar to Python, and similar, in fact, to some Lisps and schemes. And yet we don't see this same problem with them, or at least not to the same extent. So why do you think that is?
Right, not to the same extent. And I think not to the same extent is key. We do see it to some degree. NPM is not alone in that. So Geeks does a bit better of this than Debian in that I think for a long time, distributions traditionally, when you downloaded packages, there was a list of packages you got from your distribution, and you just installed those packages as root, right? And you lived in two different environments. One, which was to develop for your local language. Well, at least you did as a web developer, right? In Python, you might use virtualenv, and and other languages you may use, whatever. And you actually, we got a division, which I think is largely responsible for this mess, between the packages that were in distros, which did care a lot about licensing and reproducibility and everything, and the packages which were for development, which needed to be a lot faster moving and et cetera. Now, in Geeks, you can much more easily give a file to say, here's the environment I want to set up for development, and even use more bleeding-edge packages, and I think that's true in Nix as well. But for good reason, well, for long-standing technical reasons, this was not really possible in Debian, and maybe Debian can do better. I'm not really sure. But what's interesting to me about this is that, unfortunately, it led to a situation where there was a big disconnect between language package managers and distro package managers. And the problem that partly happened there is that a lot of these things that distro package managers had to figure out, like how you make sure that you can build things from source, how, you know, whether or not the package is properly, marked for light.
So what does that even mean? Stuff. So when I say, I know what compiling software is when I'm working with C, right? I know what compiling software is when I'm working with C++. And I know that if I'm working in Python, I get a PYC file, which is a byte compiled version of my source code. All that does is make it a little bit faster to load. Is that what we're talking about when you talk about reproducible builds in terms of an interpreted language?
Well, okay, so the reproducibility is that you're able to get the package definition and you can reproduce. So there's varying levels of reproducibility, I'd say. There's pure reproducibility, which is the ability to, you build the package, and because that package and all of its parents are all reproducible, and that includes not including any timestamps or anything like that, you can get byte for byte exactly the same package every time.
But that doesn't seem to be what you're talking about. You seem to be talking about locking down the dependencies versions, right? So if I say that I'm building a piece of software that depends on foo, I don't say I need foo. I say, well, I need foo 1.8.2. And it turns out that foo 1.8.2 requires bar 2.3. Right. So is that what we're talking about? I'm going down the wrong road here. It's a red herring, but I'm trying to understand what software reproducibility has to do with this particular problem.
Okay. Let me give you a more concrete example. Right. So in Media Goblin, we had our Python definition, and our Python definition, actually, we defined the setup.py file, and for the Python stuff, it wasn't so bad, actually. You could run the setup.py, and you would pretty much build the same thing there that you would build on the distribution side just for the Python side of things. And some languages like Python are not really that hard in that side. So you mentioned the compilation step. So maybe it's not just reproducibility. It's the capacity to build from source, right? So on the other hand, to build jQuery, you need to be able to compile all, you need to be able to do that for every single one of its little dependency pieces. And it's actually very hard to do that, especially because there are problems where there are dependency cycles in the node land where, you know, you need to build jQuery with Grunt, which depends on another build system, which depends on Grunt. And it gets really...
It
gets really hard to sort out these things, and you have to go backwards in time to be able to find it. And these are equivalent to, so language development people are probably familiar with bootstrapping problems to avoid bootstrapping solutions to avoid like Thompson type attacks. If you don't know what that is, it doesn't matter. But you should just know that it's really complicated, and NPM has that level of complicatedness throughout the whole system.
Got it.
And even worse, every language package manager is a little bit special, right? Python's is a little bit special. And JavaScript's is very special, right? And then, you know, maybe we also have something else, right? Like maybe we have some sort of Ruby utility that we call, and that's reasonably special. And each one of those, one of the problems we hit at Media Goblin was for each one of those, we needed to actually include every one of those package managers. And now suddenly, and it's like, and that is basically every time that you end up including those, it basically like, so we just said we weren't going to say exponential, but it really is exponential growth for each time that you include another one of these language package managers, the complexity multiplies on it.
Got it. Yeah. So that makes sense. So instead, sort of skipping to the chase, or what I hope is the chase here, what we end up doing, instead of trying to build all the software and trying to go through this complex process, is at some point we just kind of throw up our hands and say, well, this is the version. I trust that it was built properly.
Right, exactly. So you just ship that jQuery.js, the single jQuery file in your web application. You say, that's probably right. Right. And
especially if I got it from, let's say, jQuery.org, right? I trust that jQuery.org has the official jQuery, and that the official jQuery is the good jQuery.
Exactly. So yeah, so that's the heart of the problem. And like, so we end up in one of two camps, like, or actually both of them are kind of the same camp. It's kind of the giving up approach to software packaging. And since NPM does not have the same culture of needing to reproduce these things, this is not being really included. And it's partly the history of free software distributions being decoupled from the web development process that led to the point where we have two different packaging ecosystems, and which is why it's so hard to get web applications packaged in free software distributions.
Well, I don't think it's just... I agree with you that it's a predominantly, or where it's more, this problem is more pronounced in web development, but I don't think it's just a web development problem. So I worked in an environment, a former employer who I will not name. And for that former employer, we provided our own custom JCC. We provided a whole ton of libraries that were to the exact specification of our users who, in our department, we treated as our customers. In fact, different departments required different versions of software. And I guess the currently in vogue response to that is, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to rile you up here, is to kind of throw up your hands and say, well, okay, this is hard. This is too hard, in fact. So instead of trying to build this complicated build system that has audit capabilities throughout, use Docker, right? Or a container system. And I'm using Docker as an example, right? But I think that if I was there, that's what I'd be promoting currently. I'd say, look, we can't necessarily maintain X versions of software. I would simply inject their version of GCC into some kind of build system that would then compile packages or images in Docker world that would then get run.
Right. You're completely right. So Docker is basically like static compilation, for those who know what it is, but on the entire distribution level, right? You just,
yep.
The whole thing becomes a black box. And partly the black box thing is able to work sort of, even though it's not very safe, as you know, the topic today discusses, because many companies have a DevOps team, right? Since the focus of development has switched, and I partly think this is a user freedom versus, you know, just open source, you know, development methodology type of difference. When you're just really care about building tools for developers and you're only being oriented towards large corporations deploying things, then this might not feel like that big of a problem, right? Because you can say, well, we have a dedicated DevOps team to deploy it. That's not true if what you care about is individual users. But even there, clearly this actually affects Even larger corporations, because larger corporations are affected by the very problem that we're talking about.
You know,
in this episode.
I hate to. It's funny. We usually agree on so much. I'm going to slightly disagree with you here. So I guess there's two thoughts I've been having. One is if I agree with the Docker world, and I'm not saying I entirely do, although I want to come back to it. If I agree with the Docker world people would say, well, if you just built your software inside of Docker, right, if you containerized your application development, then these attacks wouldn't affect you. Right. So this particular attack against your Bitcoin wallet would be mitigated by the fact that in Docker, the file system access is restricted by this application. So the application would never have had access to your Bitcoin wallet unless you, for some reason, gave it explicit access. So I think there is something to be said about that. The other thing is that for developers, and we have to remember that although Docker is now promoted as a tool for large scale application management, it was originally developed as a tool for developers who worked in a system that was highly controlled, right? And so I'll use my former, actually several former employers as an example. If they wanted to develop software in, let's say, Ubuntu, and that was not our operating system of choice, you know, our answer was, well, too bad, right? We don't run Ubuntu here. We run, let's say something else. So we run something else, and you want to use Ubuntu. Well, too bad. You have to change your development process. And they would come to us and say, well, it was so much easier to write this program in Ubuntu. And you know, and then we'd have it back and forth and end up being a hostile situation where developers wanted to just focus on developing software. They didn't really care about our operating system. And then as people in charge of operations, we cared about the stability and maintainability of our systems. And we were not able to audit their source code. That was not in our domain. Right. So the promise of Docker is the idea that, as you say, it limits the interfaces. But in fact, that's the idea, right? The idea is that I simply take this thing and I run it and I don't worry about it. I think what's happened is that that's gotten slightly perverted in a way, because this idea of being able to run your Docker instance comes from the environment of, hey, this Docker image came from our employees, so we trust it, up until now, where it has become, hey, this software program, this whole other thing, is from the internet. It's some black box that I got from the internet, right? I use a lot of Docker in production. In fact, the LibreLounge.org website uses Docker, and in that I use, for example, the Nginx. Docker image, right? Well, I trust that the Nginx Docker image is built properly, but I didn't audit it. So I think that there's some truth to both sides of this.
Well, okay. So hold up. There's a reason why I said defense in depth on these multiple things, because I actually agree that encapsulation is really important. Now, I don't think, and encapsulation and confinement, right? And in fact, that's kind of where the object capability stuff goes. Now, actually, Docker is an interesting example because Docker does not do it well in many ways. It's been very easy to break out of Docker containers, and it's happened over and over and over again. So don't assume that Docker is for security, because it's not really a system that was designed primarily for security. It's been designed primarily for
ease of deployment. Yeah,
that's right. So, now, if we want to talk about containment, so this is where the object capability stuff comes in. So you wanted to quote Linus's law here, because I think that ties into what we want to say next.
I agree. Yeah, so Linus's law is that with enough eyes, all bugs are shallow. And for people who aren't familiar with that quote, what it means is that if enough people read source code, they will be able to identify bugs, and in a world where software is free and open source, it means that if they can see the bugs, they can fix the bugs. If they can fix the bugs, everyone benefits.
Yeah, and it's a great quote, and it's also, when it comes to vulnerabilities, it's not true. It's at least not true when it comes to maliciously inserted vulnerabilities. So what it is true about is that it allows us to do much better as in terms of auditing software. But I think for a long time, I bought into the idea that by having community review, it'll be possible for us to make much more secure software. And I do think that it does help improve the security of software, right? When you have all collaborating entities wanting to review software, assuming everybody's collaborating, or assuming that everyone's collaborating and the people who are malicious are incompetent, then it does help improve and discover and fix problems. So I do agree with the open source methodology that we do things better by having things be, you know, quote unquote open, right? But the idea that this is a sufficient defense is false. Ka Ping Yi, I think that's how you pronounce it, wrote a dissertation on, and we'll link to it in the show notes, about improving electronic voting security. And I actually have not read, it's called Building Reliable Voting Machine Software. So full disclosure, I have not read this all entirely myself, but I spoke to some people who have read it and were even, I think, involved in the, they were actually on the committee. Well, there's a part in it that was described to me that I found very interesting, which is apparently in this dissertation, Ka Ping Yi, you know, in trying to investigate building secure systems, was like, okay, well, can we say that if we, you know, that like code review will be able to help us find maliciously inserted code? And so what they did was they wrote a very simple language that was Python-like and had some of the best developers in the world look at it, like Mark Miller, I think Ellen Karp might have been using it, and some other people who are very, very, very security-oriented people, I think. And so what happened was there were three levels of attempts to insert intentionally malicious obscured code, and in the easier ones were found but at great effort, and the harder ones were not found by anyone. And these are with reviews by some of the people who are, you know, the best in the world reviewing this, who knew they were there and could not find them. And upon the vulnerabilities being pointed out, upon the malicious code being pointed out, everyone agreed that they should have been able to find it, but didn't. And I find that very interesting, because I feel like that tears apart that whole argument that, you know, just because we have sufficient review, that we will be able to prevent these problems.
Yeah, I think coming from a cultural standpoint rather than a technical one, there's some reasons behind that quote. And I want to come back to this, and I think we're going to need to start coming toward the end, but. If we think about when that quote was made, there's two parts to it. So first of all, having access to the source code is a requirement for being able to audit it, right? So in a system where we can't access the source code, we have no chance of auditing it. And that's vitally important. And so if we're comparing, you know, free software that is potentially auditable with non-free software that is non-auditable, then of course the free software will always win.
Absolutely.
What you're saying is it's not sufficient. The other part of this is that there was a time, and I think we're still partially in that time, when we were trying to convince people of what they were calling the open source methodology, right? This idea that, well, if you have your source code made open source, then things will happen for you. And this kind of sales technique was used by open source proponents. And I'm specifically saying open source proponents. They were saying to companies, if you open up your source code, developers will come out of the woodwork and they will start fixing your bugs for you.
Right. And that happens sometimes, but not nearly as often as it's sold.
Right. Exactly. So it as you say, it happens occasionally, but it's not enough. It on its own should not be a reason for, it's not the justification that we have for free software. We believe that free software has lots of reasons, and we also believe it has some of these practical benefits. Right. Where the open source people would say, well, it's open source is better because it has all these practical benefits. And this is one of those situations that's so important where we are getting right now to the fundamental difference between the free software and the open source communities. The open source people would say, well, clearly this is a flaw, and maybe proprietary software with paid auditors is better, and therefore an argument against open source, where we would say, no, we still need free software, but we need some kind of either auditing, which it appears from your description of that report is insufficient on its own. So auditing is not enough. And then some kind of mechanism, which I'm sure you're going to get to soon, about how even if we don't have auditing, that either code that is buggy and or malicious will be limited in the damage it can do.
Right. So we should also say that this was found through auditing, sort of, right? It was the fact that people were able to look at the code and were able to find this. And with the same thing with the ESLint thing, you know, these were more easily found because the code was open, right? So so it's not to shoot that down completely, but also how many other of these vulnerabilities are there, and how many more pieces of malicious code are there that we haven't seen, right? You know, sometimes these things sit in there for a long time, and certainly bugs and vulnerabilities, bug-based vulnerabilities sit in code bases for years and years and years, sometimes decades. So moving on, I want to quote Zuko, who had a very nice quote about this that they made on Twitter, which was, it kind of depresses me how everyone is responding to the NPM dependency injection by talking about reusing code less or vetting authors more, same thing, instead of talking about making code reuse safe. This is why I think agoric is important. I completely agree with this statement. It's also important to note that agoric is a company that is making object capability secure JavaScript software for, you know, specifically for what you would call smart contracts, which is a bit, that's kind of a whole topic of its own. But what's interesting is that they are taking the object capability approach, and the people there who some of the people who are working at agoric have actually been working for years to try to make JavaScript into a safer environment. Now, when it comes to object capabilities, that's at least an episode of its own, maybe several. So I don't want to go into super big depth on object capabilities here, but let me give you the key overview of the idea. Key overview of the idea is that libraries start with no special authority, not to the file system, not to the network, not to any of those things. And instead, you pass in authority to those libraries. So instead of the library just reaching out and saying, oh yeah, I'd like some of that network access. Oh yeah, I'd like some of that file system access. It has to be granted it. And this does not have to happen in the same way that we do it in an RBAC style system or role-based access control or access control list, where some supervisor hands things out. It can be actually the program that's calling the library. If that program has authority, that program can explicitly pass it along the same way that we pass arguments into functions. So there are reasons why this is the most secure way to do things. And I won't go into big depth on it, but you can think, oh, wait a minute. If that library did not have access to the file system and it didn't have access to the network, it would not have been able to grab your Bitcoin private keys and upload them to the network. Right?
That's true, right? So what you're saying is kind of like when you install an application on Android, and I think on iOS, right? It says, well, this program would like to do the following things, right? It would like to access your camera. It would like to look at your contacts. It would like to do whatever. And what you're saying is, okay, so when I, an application developer, I'm using a library, I might say, okay, this application does have file system access, or maybe it doesn't need file system access, or maybe it'll even be something more interesting where I'll say, oh, sure, you'll have file system access, but only to your own files, right? Only to files you create. You don't have general access to file system.
Or only to this directory.
Right, right. And so, and in fact, and at that, and that's kind of like what Cubes does, where when you, but it's, Cubes is an overlay of this kind of system where you can say, okay, well, this becomes kind of like a demilitarized zone where this becomes, and this directory is a special directory where two programs that don't normally have access to communicate with each other can explicitly transmit data between them, can exchange data between them, themselves or each other, right? So what you're saying is, okay, well, if we had this kind of ability as application developers, we could put that. And then the other part, I guess, and you didn't explicitly say this, but you could also add in an explanation from the developer about why do they need that? And maybe they only need that under certain circumstances, right? So, the file system access might be, well, I need this if I'm doing caching, or I need this if I'm doing persistence, but maybe I'm not doing persistence. Maybe everything I'm doing is ephemeral and I don't need to be able to access the file system, or maybe something else. Maybe I'm not using file system access. Maybe I'm using a database, in which case I do need network access, but I don't need file system access, and allowing.
Or you only need network access to this very specific site.
Right, right. And then I could list out that site, and that would be something that as an application deployer, right, as a DevOps person or operations, I could have control over that at the application level. And that would be very powerful.
If this library had previously not had that authority, and then suddenly the new person who overtook it added that in, then people who are using the library would now have to pass in those additional permissions, in which case they would notice that something changed, right? So that would be an opportunity to see, oh, wait, this thing doesn't need this. Why did this happen?
Right. And that also creates more of a dialogue, right? I think that's the important part here too, is if when I say, you know, if I say as an, I'm going to be your library that you're going to install, Chris, I'm going to say, well, I need file system access. And I might just say, well, I need file system access, but I might not explain to you what the reason for that is. But I could instead say, well, I need file system access. Here's my reason. And then you might say, well, your reason is silly. You don't need that. Or maybe, oh, okay, that makes sense. I understand why you need that.
Right. So I think that that's a good approximation of what we want to get. And how there are some distinctions here between what I'm suggesting and what Android is doing and what kind of the containerization approach is doing, but it's not too important for this particular episode. We can talk about that.
Yeah, and we've been talking for about an hour and 15 minutes, so we should probably start to wrap up.
Okay, I have just a couple more things to say on this topic, and then we'll wrap it up. So, this is not just theoretical. I mentioned that Mark Miller and other people at Agoric and stuff like that have been working on this for some time. There's a great talk that you can watch online. You can search for Mark Miller, and the topic is Securing ECMAScript Presentation to Node Security. We'll also link it in the show notes, and he explains how to do this. Now, disappointingly, in this presentation to the Node Security group, it sounded like the particular audience was very skeptical. They're like, well, the stuff that we're doing is kind of working and stuff like that. We don't, you know, like a lot of skepticism that really, really need this. But maybe that perspective will change now, right? We've seen a number of these vulnerabilities, and maybe people will start to change their minds about that attitude. And this also isn't just an NPM problem. I do think for the other reasons we discussed about the accountability and reproducibility aspects make NPM a bit worse, which makes this a little bit more dire. But I do think that we actually have gotten to the state where, you know, as you said, there's so much code running on your operating system that there's no way that you can feasibly audit all that. And even an organization like Debian, which tries to be very, which tries to do a good job of vetting packages, there's no way that a maintainer managing a few hundred packages can audit all those. Impossible, right? So we need this more across the board, but how to be able to get there, and some of this stuff has been developed actually for decades, is a topic of itself. So I'm going to close it up there.
All right. I think that we had a nice in-depth discussion about NPM, and I think we brought up a lot that I'll be interested to see what our audience has to say and places that they might want us to go and take this conversation going forward. With that, do we have anything else we want to close with?
How about shout-outs? Shout-out time?
Sure.
Okay. The last episode, we talked about org mode and organization things, and you mentioned how you were doing organization about using kind of A, B, and C style level of tasks, right?
Right, the cycle system. Yeah.
So I incorporated ideas from what you were doing. So I just wanted to say that this show is already impacting me. I overhauled my org mode setup. I could give the code that I'm using in a brief form so that we could put it on the show notes. I don't see any reason why not. I basically updated it to incorporate that, and I'd say it's been a big improvement having the ABC stuff, which I had previously rejected because I felt like I never really quite knew what to mark as ABC. But then what I realized was if I stopped abusing the schedule and deadline properties, where I would be like, this needs to be on my radar, and just switch it so that my default priority level was D, which is basically no priority, and then I would mark things as A, B, and C when I wanted them on my agenda, then the scheduled and deadline properties could actually take on the meaning they were supposed to have, as opposed to just get on my agenda, which is right. What they were doing previously.
That makes a lot of sense.
I'm also giving a talk at Northeastern University's Programming Language Lab, I think it's called, on December 7th. I guess we can link to it in the show notes. It's going to be about, it's December 4th, Tuesday,
where
December
is that?
4th. It's at Northeastern University's Language Lab, which is in Boston.
Got it.
Or Cambridge, I guess. So if you're interested in that, I think Northeastern's in Cambridge. I really do not know that area well enough. So I did not look up all the details before I spoke on this episode, so I guess I'll have to link it. But if you're interested and you somehow listen to this episode right before then, maybe you want to show up to that.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. What are you going to talk about?
It's going to be about the Goblins library that I'm writing, which is a distributed actor model system in Racket, and also the larger goals of what I'm trying to approach, which is the building distributed virtual worlds for the Fediverse.
Well, that sounds really awesome. I'm jealous of the people who'll be able to attend that.
Okay, so anything you want to shout out?
No, just we had some really great feedback from people, especially on the Fediverse. And now that I've joined the Fediverse, I see how much, at least for now, at this time, it's a much kinder, gentler place than Twitter. Now, of course, as the Fediverse grows, I'm sure that will grow and shift as well. But we got some really wonderful, kind feedback. And I especially want to shout out to Voltaire from the show Off the Hook, which is a show that I listened to since the 90s, and he had some kind words to say. So to shout out to him, and also just generally, we are absolutely looking for feedback on any aspect of the show. So if there's something that you loved, something that you hated, something that you wish was different, something that you wish we would talk about, we are we are, I don't want to say desperate, because we're not desperate. We have a ton of ideas, but we really want your feedback. We really, I think both of us thrive on that. We really need attention. So please send us feedback on the show.
We're one episode in, the second episode in, and we've already made some changes to how we structured this episode based on feedback. So we will also listen.
I'm going to give one other shout out, and I know you're going to close with this in the closing anyway, but I know that you have, and I don't think we've talked about this as explicitly, but you know, you quit your job, or at least are in the process of closing out, and are doing free software full time and free software advocacy full time, and that's so exciting and so important. And I just want everyone to go to your Patreon and support you. So,
well, that's very kind. I am doing some contracting, but it's in a very reduced fashion. So enough reduced that I'm still able to do the free software stuff full time. And, you know, it would be great to not work 1.5 jobs, too.
So we're gonna make sure to link in the show notes and also on the website to your Patreon so people can support you.
Very good. Thanks, everybody.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.